Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting with Sherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Good morning, well, good evening, and wherever else in the world you are, welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today I'm welcoming back award-winning author Eileen Mueller. We were supposed to talk to her earlier today, which is why I just did that flip-up, but we had some communication problems with phone systems and all that stuff. Anyway, so I have recorded the show, so please don't call in. Eileen is an award-winning author. She has written several books. She's written a series of books, and basically they are amazing. Here's Eileen.
Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. It's been about a year?
About a year. Yep, I talked to you last year.
And you got a whole bunch of new stuff that's happening. And you won awards. You've had an exciting time.
Yeah, it's been a really exciting year. I've enjoyed it.
What were the awards that you won?
So my series, last time when we spoke, my series Riders of Fire had just released, and that was in October last year. And books 1 and 2 came out last year, and they were nominated for a New Zealand award called the Storylines Notable Books Award. And this is run by a literary community in New Zealand, and they give awards to children's books, and because these are young adult books, they both received the Notable Books Award. It's not an exclusive award, it's an award where they compile a list of books on the Notable Books. So I think there were, all from memory, somewhere under 10 and over 5, maybe 7 or 8 books on that list, and on the young adult category, and my two books were both up there. So I was extremely surprised. I've won awards in the past in the Science Fiction and Fantasy Association in New Zealand, but I hadn't expected a literary award from the literary sector. So that was a very pleasant surprise, and I got to travel up to Auckland and meet all the representatives from Scholastic and Walker Books and Penguin and all the other authors who'd won awards. It was wonderful.
That's really cool.
Yeah. My books are indie published, of course, so they were quite surprised that an indie published author had received the award, I felt it was very good for people to see that there's quality in indie books as well.
Absolutely, and you got a literary award, so that shows that you're very popular. I mean, you're very popular, but you're very well written.
Thank you.
That's really cool. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, I was very pleased.
Isn't Scholastic the one that does Harry Potter? Did Harry Potter?
Sorry? Oh, no, they did. Bloomsbury published Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah. I guess Scholastic here in the States, because that's who did it here.
Ah, okay. Yep. I could be wrong, but I believe it was Bloomsbury. And Scholastic distribute a lot of books worldwide for various people. Here in New Zealand, you can get your books distributed with them if you publish indie, but you have to do massive print runs to do that, so that's another distribution option for people as well, but they're one of the big publishers here.
Oh, yeah, I think they're international.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Actually, it may have been Scholastic. I'm thinking we have some American edition Harry Potter books, and I think they've got Scholastic on the front.
Yeah, mine
so
do.
I could have said something wrong there.
Mine has Scholastic, so that's why it came into my head. I was rereading it. That's why I was like, Scholastic, that sounds really familiar.
Okay, yeah, you're right. It's Bloomsbury in the UK, and Scholastic have distributed it in the States, I think. So, interesting.
Hey, maybe your book will follow the same route. You never know.
I think a lot of people would love to be like J.K. Rowling. I think not many of us will achieve that, but it's a fantastic aspiration.
That's like the dream, isn't it? Impoverished mother suddenly becomes multi-millionaire,
and is able to build an amazing theme park in their home. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
That covers all of that.
I still haven't gotten to go. I've had all these friends go, and there's one that's in Florida, and there's one in LA, the park, and I still haven't gone. I can't. I haven't been able to afford it.
But no, that's another my kids, I think they'd all like to go there. Most of my kids read and reread the series. So, yeah, I think, you know, J.K. Rowling having that sort of success and Stephanie Meyer having her success as Twilight, I think are part of the things that have sparked some of the indie revolution, because people have seen authors. We say people come out of nowhere and they're an overnight success, and that's not true. There's a lot of work that goes in the background. I wrote for 10 years before I published this particular series, and the series had some bestseller tags on Amazon, and it's had some wonderful acclaim. It's also had some harsh critics. You get that when you've got books that are selling, you get a bit of both. I've had readers compare my books to Dragon Riders of Pern, and I've had reviews that say it's nothing like Pern. So it just depends on your perspective and where you're coming from. So I think it's an interesting journey, and I think that their success actually opened up a lot of the closing something on my computer that made a noise. I apologise for that. So I think that their success showed people that they could have a chance at writing and actually, you know, becoming popular and having people enjoy their literature.
It's funny, I actually trust something like Goodreads for the reviews much more than I do Amazon. Amazon seems to have people review that just want to be mean.
Mm-hmm. I've had people say that on Goodreads as well. So I think it just depends on the luck of the draw when you know, the type of readers that you attract. My first review on Goodreads was terrible, but it was because the person had objected to the cover. So that was really interesting.
The cover?
There were three dragons on it, and so that particular person thought it was a rip-off of Pern, because apparently one of the Pern covers had three dragons on it as well. So if you're not familiar with the Pern series back in the 70s and 80s, Dragon Riders of Pern became very popular, and it was Anne McCaffrey's series, and so she's the iconic sort of dragon rider writer. And she has a mix of science fiction with a fantasy sort of world. So she sets her world on planets and has dragon riders fighting this terrible stuff that falls from the sky called Thread, which is like burns through everything and destroys it. It destroys organic material. So it will destroy living tissue and trees and people and things. So, and it falls for 7 years. And so these dragon riders have to fight it. And one of the things that people love about her world is the telepathic bond between dragons and rider, and the feeling that they found their ultimate partner in life in terms of, you know, friendship and companionship, because the dragon understands them completely, you know. So I think that's something that people really enjoy. So I grew up on those and loved them, and as did a lot of other people. There are a lot of other people who've written successful dragon rider fiction, like Ursula Le Guin, Naomi Novik, Patrick Rothfuss. There's so many different people who've written fiction with dragons and other people enjoy. Christopher Paolini, of course. And I've just always loved dragons, so when I started writing, that was what I started writing about.
It's funny, you were saying that they were like upset because of the cover, and I was like, dragons have been around since the Middle Ages. I really don't think anybody has a monopoly on dragons. I mean, they had dragons in the Arthur legend books, and, you know, I mean, there's always dragons, so it's kind of silly.
Yeah, having three on a cover is a question of balance. The artist is balancing out the big dragon in the centre with two tiny wee ones in the background, and that's just something you do. The fact that the woman who was riding the dragon was blonde had nothing to do with Anne McCaffrey's books, and yet that person, you know, was a bit upset that the cover had reminded her of Anne McCaffrey's book. So that was quite interesting for me. To see that people can feel so strongly about a series they love. And I've got fans that feel that strongly about my series now. They absolutely love it, and they're always writing to me and saying, when's the next one coming out? Can you write faster? I'm not a very fast writer, so I'm not as fast as some people who can churn out a book in a month. I cannot do that.
Oh my God, a book a month?
Yeah,
it takes me like 6 months just to get the first draft.
There are some people that do their first draft in a week. It's absolutely incredible. I am a very slow typist. I think about things, I rewrite them, I edit them. I recently started dictation in an effort to be faster, but I found I think out loud quite well. It took me a while to get into that mindset. And I can actually dictate a book in 2 weeks, which is crazy, if I've done all my plotting. Of course, I've got all my world established, all my characters already established, because I'm moving on in the series. I can dictate a book in 2 weeks, which is crazy, but that takes me all day. I go walking for 4 to 6 hours and dictate everything, and then I have to come back and spend a long time, way longer than that, editing it, because it ends up being quite a rough draft with ideas thrown in, and oh, try a scene like this, and oh, hello, good morning, as I'm talking to someone. My dictation process isn't a neat and tidy one. There are a lot of people out there that dictate very tidily, and they have neat, tidy paragraphs when they're finished, and mine ends up being a big sprawling manuscript with lots of little notes that say, you know, I dictate, bracket, open bracket, in that last scene, make sure that this happens, and then I'll go close bracket, and then I'll keep dictating, and so I go and hunt through for all the brackets when I log in, once my machine transcribes it. I go and hunt for all the brackets and go make notes in the right scenes, and then I start the process of rewriting. So I basically rewrite the entire book from scratch that I've dictated. But the beauty in doing that is that when you dictate, it's all alive and it's fresh, and it's amazing to get a manuscript down that fast. And then when you go back and work on it, you can work on the nuances and rephrase the dialogue and use different verbs and put in some beautiful imagery and layer some of the meaning in. So yeah, that's been a really interesting process. And the thing I love most about it is that my office became the outdoors. I was out dictating at the beach. I live here in Wellington, New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Zealand, in Wellington, it's a small city. It's a capital city, but it's quite small. And I live 3 minutes from downtown Wellington. And straight across the road from me is a forest. And 5 minutes drive from where I live, or maybe 6 or 7 minutes drive, there is a beach. And Wellington is surrounded by beaches. We're on the end of an island, and there's a big sort of peninsula that looks out and a harbour. So wherever I drive, whichever direction, except north, I hit a beach if I just keep driving for 5 or 10 minutes. So I spent time dictating beach scenes. So sometimes what I would do is go to a beach if I was dictating a coastal scene. I'd go for a walk in a forest if I was dictating, you know, an attack in the forest by monsters. And it made everything feel a lot more real, because I was out in the atmosphere of where I was sort of trying to create a scene. And the other thing that happened is, as I was editing these scenes and rewriting them, I would see where I had been. So I'd be editing the scene I dictated, walking down a set of steps in a forest and then going around a corner and up a cliff or something, you know, alongside a cliff, and I would see that again as I was actually editing, which is something I didn't expect.
That's interesting. It's funny, I was thinking, if I did that in my apartment, there would be brackets around no pie.
Cute little kitty cat, right?
Yeah, you know, she's like a toddler, you know, you have to continually, you know, make sure she doesn't get into trouble.
like a naughty dragonette.
Yes, exactly, a little dragon, a little cute furry dragon.
Luckily she doesn't breathe fire, you'd have blisters on your fingers.
Oh, please, I already have the scars, I don't need blisters too. But I was thinking, Wellington was actually on television here in the States this week. Was it this week or last week? It was. Did you ever hear of an American show called The Steve Colbert Show? It's a nighttime talk show.
Mm-hmm. Tell me all about it.
Well, Lucy Lawless and what is his name? He's a singer. Was introducing Steven to life as a Kiwi. And it was hilarious. But it was really beautiful, because we got to see a lot of Wellington with him. But it was really introducing him to, I don't remember what they called it, but it was like spaghetti inside a shell, and you eat it like a sandwich.
Right, yeah.
And it was like canned spaghetti, and he said, yep. Oh, okay.
A toasty pie, probably, or a toasted sandwich.
Yeah, and she said, and then there was another one Lucy gave him, that was the guy who I can't think of his name. Lucy gave him a piece of white bread with sausage, and he goes, you guys don't do much with buns, do you?
No, we do. We have sausages rolled up in bread with onions. I think it's a British thing. So even when we eat fish and chips, which you've probably heard of, which is, you know, deep fried fish with batter on it and chips.
I've had it.
French fries, right? But we call them chips.
Chips.
And they're fat and chunky.
They're good.
And we even have ones called wedges, which are even fatter and have lots of spices on the outside. But when we eat those, I remember growing up as a kid and making what's called chip butties, which is a...
I haven't heard of.
What the British have, yeah, which is bread and butter with your fish and chips inside. So a lot of people like to put things in sandwiches here, which is quite a British thing.
No, when I was in England, I had to have fish and chips. I mean, because I'd grown up, there was a place when I was a little girl. A guy was an actor who blanked out in my head, right? Arthur Treacher was a British actor. And he had a Arthur Treacher's fish and chips. It was all over the West Coast. I don't know if it made it to the East Coast, but I know it was in the West Coast. And so we used to go there quite often because we all love them, you know. And my mom, who was from New England, grew up on fish and chips. So she was joyful to introduce her children to real fish and chips.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it stopped. You know, L.A. and their fads disappeared. So when I went to England, I had to get real fish and chips. That was one of my goals with the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. So I've had real authentic.
Sorry?
I've had real authentic fish and chips.
Yeah, well, when I was in London, one of the first things I did was go and buy fish and chips. And I had been living in Switzerland. My husband is Swiss, and I met him over there. And we travelled to London together because my boss couldn't believe that I had never been to London and I was a Kiwi and I'd lived on the continent for a couple of years. So he sent me to London. I had a business trip I had to go on, so he sent me to London. I took my husband along too. And we got to London. I was like, right, we have to buy fish and chips.
First.
And I was so disappointed. They were terrible.
Really?
They were oily and greasy and the fish wasn't fresh and the chips tasted stale. And
where did you go?
I was just somewhere in Covent Garden, so we just bought them off a fish and chip shop there. It was completely an unremarkable one. Even if I knew the name, I wouldn't want to say it because you wouldn't want to go there.
No, I had the one in, I had it in Bath. I had it in Bath. Even though it's a tourist thing, it was really good.
So then when we went out to the country, so I went to a place called Forest Row to see where Winnie the Pooh had been. And we went to a fish and chip shop there. Someone recommended, they said, go to the local pub and get the fish and chips.
That's it, yes.
And they were fantastic. They were excellent. And they said, don't buy them in London.
That's exactly. I was warned, though. I was warned not to buy it in London by a friend who was British. Because in the travel agency that I worked at, they said, don't buy it in London, they're crap. Buy it when you go to, and if you're going to England, you have to go to some place in the country. So I went to Stratford-on-Avon and Bath.
And did you see any dragons there, Sherry?
No. I'm sorry. I didn't. I wish I did, but I didn't. I didn't see one dragon.
I always have my eye out for dragons. Like, there's one on a street lamp somewhere in Copenhagen, and there's lots of different dragons. So if you've got dragons on your mind, you can find them anywhere. And I was out at a soccer game recently with my kids. It was earlier this year. My girl plays soccer. She's 11. And we were coming back down. She said, Mum, look! And she pointed to a street sign, and it said Dragon Street. I couldn't believe it. We had to get photos, and of course I forgot to put them in social media because I got busy. So, yeah, it was quite funny.
I remember...
hundreds of photos of dragons and often forget to post them on social media. They're all sitting on my drive somewhere.
I think you'd appreciate this. This is when I was in college, and one of my first lectures, and I've seen him many times after, was with Ray Bradbury. And what he was actually supposed to be talking about is a career as a writer. But he was obsessed with dragons, so the entire talk was about dragons.
That's interesting.
Did you know Ray Bradbury was obsessed with dragons?
No, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. He loved dragons, so the whole talk was about dragons. It was, but nobody bought it. It didn't bother anybody. We were all fascinated because he was a great talker. great speaker. But yeah, so we go in thinking we're going for a vocational talk with a world famous author, and instead we got a lecture on dragons.
I mean, he did write, he did have a short story published in 1955 called The Dragon. So, you know, about two knights who were going to slay a dragon. So, you know, it makes sense that he was like dragons. I just didn't know he was that obsessed that talk about writing would end up being about dragons. But I can see how that would happen. Obviously, I have a bias.
Dragons and dinosaurs, those were his favorite things.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, you made me think of it because it was like I was barely 18, so it was a long time ago.
I think, you know, I've seen that quite a few times that I've seen writers, you know, start to talk about their favorite topic, and everybody's fascinated, even if it isn't quite what they thought they'd signed up for.
Yeah. Who cares?
Often they speak quite well. Yeah, they're getting something interesting. Yeah, that's good.
Well, he had everybody in the palm of his hand, so I don't think I don't think the people that were in charge minded. We only have a little time, so I want to give you some time to talk about your new book that just came out on Thanksgiving, and any other things that you want to tell people that they can get, or anything that's coming up.
Okay, so my website is EileenMuellerAuthor.com, and on my website I have some free books, and I love giving those away to people. They're called Bronze Dragon and Silver Dragon, and they are both they're prequels to the actual series, and they involve the parents of the main character. Of course, when it's set, those parents are young. They're both about 17, 18 at the time as well. So those two stories are available. I just wanted to tell people now in case I forget. And the first book in the series is Azara, and that has, people might remember that from last year, but that's about a girl who grows up in a village where it's a crime to even mention dragons. And right in the first chapter, she meets the Queen of the Dragons and becomes the Queen's rider and is whisked off to a new life in Dragon's Hold amid treachery and all sorts of issues and a violent enemy who's hell-bent on destruction and creates cloned monsters that sort of are like warthogs, but they walk upright and like destroying people. So that sort of becomes her mission, to try and negotiate her way through the politics at Dragon's Hold and to learn how to become a dragon rider. So the book two is A Dragon Hero, which is about what happens to her brother, her twin brother, when he gets left behind in Lush Valley, the place where they've grown up. The thing about these stories is that they didn't know their parents had been dragon riders and had been banished in the past for a terrible crime they committed. And so the family is left with the stigma. And the parents had actually trained the kids to sword fight and to have all the skills they'd need in a battle, but they'd never told them why. They'd just said, oh, you know, you need these skills, and they challenged them all the time and taught them. So they actually had some really good fighting skills, but they had no knowledge about dragons whatsoever and weren't even sure if they existed. So that sets up a fun premise for, you know, all the things that can go wrong because they don't know what they're doing. But at the same time, it gives them some baseline skills, which they have as they're confronting monsters and trying to triumph over evil. The book goes on to Dragon Rift, which is about Azara has found a love interest. I won't give you any spoilers, but in Dragon Rift they're separated and he's been caught by the enemy. And they have to figure out why no one's rescuing him. So there's more politics going on there. And also that's where the mages come into the story more. We've got a rift that has happened between mages and riders years beforehand, and we've got a young cheeky prankster who decides, you know, he'd like to heal that rift if he can, but everything keeps going wrong, of course, because he doesn't think things through. He's actually become a favourite character. A lot of my readers really love him. His name's Kirian, which is a Welsh name. And they love him because he's so impulsive and he's so daring and he's got such a good heart and he keeps messing up time and time again.
I can understand that. Messing up and having a good heart. I really relate.
Yeah. And he's really cheeky. Like, he's absolutely cheeky. And at the beginning of the story in Dragon Rift, he's being blasted for... he's hidden all the arrows. There's some... competition between the blade thrusters and the arrow flingers, as they call each other. And so to get them all back, he hides all the arrows. And, of course, he comes under fire from the leader of Dragon's Hold because he has, if there's a battle, they've got no weapons. And he didn't think of it. He just went to hide the arrows. But the way he hid them was so ingenious that the leader's impressed anyway. I can't tell you what happens because that was ruined the story in the book. So he's like, oh my goodness, if we could harness this guy's talent, maybe we could make something out of him. So that's quite fun. And Dragon Strike, in Dragon Strike, which just released in Thanksgiving, that's book four in the series, we have all of these characters coming into play again. And in Dragon Strike, Azara and her husband have just been married, and they're away in the south in a whole different culture, and she's experiencing all of that. They've got a week to go on honeymoon, or a few days to go on honeymoon before they're due back to prepare for war. And of course they're attacked, things go wrong, we have to find out what happens later. But in the meantime, you've got Kirian, has a major part in that story as well, and he's tasked with going undercover to find out what's happening, and he has to go undercover and join a street gang, which is a really challenging thing for him to do. So there's a lot of fun you can have there with, you know, people gambling and sort of street talk and gang politics and things like that. So that's a lot of fun in that book. But the main premise of Dragon Strike, which launched on just last Thursday, was that on Thanksgiving, the main premise is that the man who's been cloning all these monsters called Varroks has also cloned some dark dragons, and they're attacking.
Cool.
So, so instead of the battles being in the forest and in amongst the mountains and by the lakes, the battles are now in the sky.
I know that you have your appointments coming up. I want to thank you for taking your time out to come on the show. I really appreciate you doing that.
You're welcome. Talking.
it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Sherry, and I'd love to talk to you again another time.
Thank you, and thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Thank you.